She kept her eyes on the floor. Her face was so thin that she looked almost starved. As his senior aide, she ate well, but somehow she always looked on the edge of starvation. The close-cropped hair did not help, except in creating an air of lean piety. It was an impression that was often useful.
"Did she agree?" he asked.
"No," said Claudia. "I was unable to secure Sister Agata's agreement to your proposal." Iacto felt his face harden for a second. He looked back at the reflection of the chain of office in the mirror. It, like the private chambers he stood in, was a sign of the heights he had climbed in the last 2 decades.
"We will have to find another route to resolve the matter," he said.
"There must be a way," snapped Claudia. "Everyone has a lever that can be pulled." He gave a dry snort of laughter and turned from the mirror.
"You do not know much of the most holy Adepta Sororitas. Difficult and dangerous does not even come close. Try to pressure them, and it often ends badly. They don't have attachment to restrain them, you see. They are willing to do things that some might call insane, and others call true devotion."
"She said that you are a slave to your ambition."
"Well, I'm glad that my soul does not rest in the hands of Sister Agata, then," he said, and smiled. "If the Sister Superior will not act because of her own conscience, then we will have to find another way to put pressure on the beloved bishop. Do matters continue to worsen?"
Claudia nodded. "The reports of unrest are increasing. The beggar orders say that hunger is rife in the Drift and the pilgrim holes. They are latching onto every scrap of fear and hope," she said. He marked the hard gleam in her eye as she spoke, and reminded himself that, as useful and effective as she was, he would one day have to deal with her before she became a threat. "They are cattle, searching for hope and finding fear. All it will take is a cause or voice to rally around, and there will be blood and fire. There are words of a new sect, penitents, whose mark are their red rags," she snorted. "Even this morning there is word of a red-clad pilgrim who could be cut and not bleed. They're calling it a miracle, and the girl a blessed messenger. If their heresy was not enough to earn them their suffering, their credulity should."
He laughed and shrugged. "Is there any use we can make of this girl?"
Claudia shook her head. "No, Your Holiness, it is nothing." She paused, and a small smile twitched her lips. "But there is something else."
"Ah," he thought, "this is what she really came to tell me, and she is so proud that she saved it to the end."
He moved towards the door. Claudia moved in front of him and pulled it open.
"Tell me as we walk," he said.
"Another ship has broken orbit and made for the system edge," she said, her voice low. Their steps echoed as they moved down the corridor beyond. A freezing wind was pouring down from the open roof of the structure above. Torch flames streamed and guttered in iron brackets. This was the Walk of the Pious, a road as much as a corridor, wide enough that 2 cargo transports could have passed each other without touching. It ran for 3 kilometers through the monastery's heart, linking the House of Concordance and the Great Cathedral. Its walls went up and up until they met an open lattice of iron, from which the skulls of the blessed dead hung on chains. When the winds were high, you could hear the chains clinking and the clack of bones knocking together. Pilgrims called the sounds the voices of the ascended.
"Which ship?" he asked.
A procession from the weighted order of penance passed them, iron chains rattling across the flagstones behind them. He was careful to bow respectfully.
"A hauler called the Bounty of Stars," said Claudia in a sharp whisper.
"Carrying food?"
"Yes,"
nodded Claudia. A crowd of penitents in grey robes were approaching from the opposite direction, and he had to nod solemnly as they paused to bow to him.
"Did it unload its cargo?"
"No, it broke orbit, still fully laden. The representatives of the Chartist captains are refusing all requests to meet with the deacons."
Iacto blinked.
how much of the grain reserve has been used? 5/8
at last measure.
And that was?
5 days ago.
Dominicus Secundus.
The riots are still burning, and the agri-guilds trebled their prices within an hour of the Bounty of Stars breaking orbit.
They are playing a dangerous game. The Adeptus Terror must be within a hair of stepping in and confiscating their holdings.
Maybe, Your Holiness, but they haven't yet.
Iacto lapsed into silence, smiling and offering the sign of the Aquila to the groups of clergy that were growing in number as they drew closer to the House of Concordance.
Who else knows?
The deacons, and the high confessors of the great cathedrals, and the administratum adepts, of course. News of it has not got out yet, but it will.
Iacto smiled and paused to bow and exchange signs of blessing with a cluster of blind scribes being led by a pack of cyber-implanted dogs on gilded chains. The dogs barked. One of them took the chance to spread a pool of urine across the flagstones. Iacto stepped carefully over the steaming puddle as he continued on. He could see the doors of the House of Concordance now, the blaze of the Empress Halo spreading across the 50-foot-high slabs of night wood and iron.
Make sure that the news reaches, oh, Abbess Linnis, just after Archdeacon Sewell begins his address. That would be best, don't you think?
Difficult in the time we have, Your Holiness.
Difficult, yes, but it will be done. You will find a way.
Your Holiness wishes to start riots.
Abbess Linnis, just after Archdeacon Sewell begins his address, said Iacto carefully. Make sure it is done.
Claudia did not answer, but bowed her head briefly and slipped away. When he glanced back, he saw her vanishing through one of the narrow side doors set into the walls. They were called whisper doors, and they linked every part of the monastery sprawl, offering ways for lower orders to pass swiftly without having to pause to give respect to their seniors, or slip past a slow-moving ceremony. Some had called such behaviour impious, but the doors remained and were used simply because devotion could only go so far when running a monastery complex housing over 3 million souls. The divine emperor of mankind could send miracles and visions, but for everything else, he needed minds that could understand particle necessity. The words of saints and the might of angels might lead humanity to salvation, but even in that blessed future, there would need to be people who understood that crops and shelter and authority were necessities. As he stepped beneath the arch of the House of Concordance, Abbot Iacto reflected that he was glad to be such a man.
"And you have told no one else of this?" asked Zelita. Agata shook her head.
"No one."
Zelita turned her head to look at where the candles burned on the small altar. Her chains clinked.
"Do you know what my predecessor said to me when he was dying?"
Zelita shuffled to the altar, lifted a fresh candle from a box beside it, and lit it from one of those that had burned almost to the nub.
"He said, 'This is not a monastery. It is the holy imperium of man, writ small enough that we can see it. What passes here echoes the greater truth of the God Emperor's realm. As above, so below. Never forget that.'
The bishop placed the candle on the altar and bowed her head for a second. The gilded face of the emperor looked down on her, flanked by Saints Goneril and Sebastian Thor.
"I never really agreed. Not then. Not until recent times retaught the lesson. Ships flee from the system. Dark omens and visions of hope come as night gathers to fall. A storm is coming, they say, and all the threads of what we know fray and snap. As above, so below indeed."
"Do you believe I am losing my mind?" asked Agata, after a long moment of quiet.
"You are not losing your mind, but beyond that, I do not know what to believe."
She turned and motioned to one of her attendants. The man came forward and handed her a brass scroll tube.
The bishop raised the jewel lens at one end to her right eye. A beam of light flicked out, and a moment later the cylinder unlocked with a clatter of releasing mechanisms. Agatha remained silent and watched as the bishop removed the scroll. She looked at the words scribed across it for a moment, and then handed it to Agatha.
"The astropaths in the Crow Complex have been able to get few messages out, and have been able to receive even fewer. This one came through clear enough that most of it could be transcribed before the receiver fell into a coma."
Agatha read the transcription and interpretation of the message the astropath had heard while he listened to the immaterium. She looked up as she finished, not trying to keep the shock from her face.
"In the realm of the soul there are no such things as coincidences," said Zelita, taking the parchment from Agatha and replacing it in its case. "The Inquisition is coming here?" she asked, still shocked.
In all her years, she had seen a member of the Holy Ordos only once, and that at a distance. They were the Emperor's judgment and authority made manifest.
"To this monastery, in fact," said Zelita. "Do any of the rest of the clergy or orders know?"
"Not yet," said Zelita, locking the case with a snap. "This message was only received in the last few hours, and no one else in the monastery has the sanction for it."
"Why is an inquisitor coming here?" asked Agatha.
Zelita let out a long breath before speaking.
"The season of night is about to fall across us. We are on the precipice of famine, and unless I am wrong, bloodshed. Miracles are proclaimed daily. Yours is not the only account of visions and ill omen I have heard. And unto this, the left hand of the God Emperor himself comes, like the last warrior across a bridge, before the floodwater takes it."
She looked again at the candle-lit altar.
"The reason the Inquisition comes here worries me less than the question that comes just after. Why now?"
"May I humbly submit to my brothers and sisters, bound as we are not just by devotion, indeed by the truth of our common creed, manifold in its many paths, just as his radiance is divided, as the light of dawn divides when it strikes the jewel."
Archdeacon Saul droned on, his voice growling from the speaker-fitted cherubs fluttering above the racked seats that circled the chamber. Iacto kept his face impassive. Many of his brothers and sisters were less caring of decorum. Abbess Granta had rolled her head back and was holding the bridge of her nose as though the pain she was experiencing was only just under her control. Prior Nasem's head had lolled down onto his chest as soon as the archdeacon had taken the rostrum.
"The soul of humanity is the soul of the Imperium, blessed as it is under the gaze of the God Emperor, praise eternal to his name. And so, when we consider all matters that pertain to his realm, be they matters great or small, we talk not just of the physical, but of matters both numinous and eternal."
It was a ruse, of course. Saul was using boredom as a weapon. As the archdeacon droned on and the 201 representatives of the orders listened, the monastery and every soul in it was creeping towards starvation and anarchy. And no one knew what to do. That was the problem with power. The people who could claim it were so rarely those who could wield it effectively. No matter, in crisis there was always opportunity to correct that state of affairs.
"And by our deliberations here in this place, so do we do more than talk."
Movement caught Iacto's eye, and he saw a senior brother in the Hessian robes of the Order of the First Blessing hurry down between the seated representatives. A few others looked too, but Saul did not falter in his droning delivery.
"It's going to be difficult to ignore in a moment, though, you pompous old fool," thought Iacto.
The brother of the first blessing stopped beside Abbess Linnis and bent down to whisper something in her ear. He saw her stiffen, her scar-pocked face creasing in concentration and then anger. She stood. That was the trouble with pure conviction. It allowed so little space to be anything other than predictable.
The role of the faithful is not simply to believe, though the devotion of those who... How many weeks are we from starving?
Abbess Linus's voice rose loud and clear. Ayakto stared at her, frowning, his face a mirror of the confusion on the other faces around the chamber. Sul looked for a second as though he was going to try and just carry on.
How long have you known that the last provision ship just fled the system without unloading?
Sul looked at Linus. He was trying to keep himself composed, trying to think. Ayakto could almost see the tensions pulling at his face.
The Blessed Abbess is interrupting the correct order of precedence.
How long until there is no food?
Murmurs rippled through the chamber. Saul glanced around, rheumy eyes flickering between the hardening stairs.
How long until famine stalks these halls? Called Linus.
The old woman was almost shining with anger.
And why have you kept its coming from us?
I...
began Saul, then hesitated. Ayakto had to work hard not to grin.
The situation is not a matter ready to be discussed in this chamber.
Uproar. Shouts rose as half the house took to their feet. Ayakto let the sound wash over him, as holy men and women shouted at the archdeacon, at each other, for the sake of shouting. The House of Concordance had always been a gathering at odds with its name. There were over 500 orders, shrine-keepers and sects in the Monastery of the Last Candle, all following their own version of the Imperial Creed. Some had existed for millennia, some for years. Nominally, each held its own place under the sacred dominion of the ecclesiarchy. In practice, there was a hierarchy. There was precedence, subtle and not so subtle lines of authority and influence. The ultimate expression of that was the House of Concordance. 200 men and women sat in the chamber and discussed the secular matters of the monastery. Those 200 places were a matter of tradition, and in rare cases, merit. Ayakto's own order had only held a seat for 800 years, and that simply because the Sage Order of the Faithful controlled the second and third most important pilgrim shrines in the complex. That made them wealthy, not in a spiritual sense, but in the same sense that had made gold and jewels and the coins that rattled into offering bowls valuable since the beginning of human history. They had money, and even in these sacred halls, that mattered. There were three positions that were most important of all in the monastery. The bishop of the great cathedral, who was the supreme spiritual authority, the archdeacon, who administered all the holdings of the ecclesiarchy, and the voice of the concordance, who spoke for the orders in all matters and was their de facto leader. There had not been a voice for 2 years since the death of the previous incumbent. In that time, no one had succeeded in marshalling enough support to take the office. With Bishop Zelita in her dotage, Archdeacon Saul had worked hard to maintain his effective monopoly on authority. Ayakto had seen no way to change that. Until now. The clamour in the chamber was reaching a peak. The guards from the bearers of the lamp shifted nervously around the base of the rostra. The ceremonial scythes they bore shifted in their hands. Saul was shouting for order. Voices were joining his and others shouting back. Static screeched from the circling cherubs. Ayakto stood. Most did not look at him. He waited, then tapped the inside of one of his rings of office.
Blessed!
The amplified word cut through the chamber as each of the cherubs spoke the word with perfect clarity. Silence fell, and Ayakto spoke into that silence. His voice was now unamplified, strong and carrying, but measured.
Blessed sisters and brothers, if what Abbess Linnis has said is true, then it must have an answer. We must have an answer.
He looked around the chamber.
and we must give the Most Reverend Archdeacon an opportunity to give us that answer." He turned to Saul and gave a small bow, then sat down. Saul appeared uncertain how to respond to this intervention, but after a second returned the bow, and then looked around at the expectant sea of faces. He closed his mouth for a second. A gust of chill air from an unsealed door stirred the yellow wisps of his long hair and beard.
"You look old, Your Reverence," thought Iacto. "I wonder how old and weak you feel at this moment."
"My thanks for the wisdom of Abbot Iacto," said Saul at last. "As to the matter that Abbess Linis—"
"And with such words you would hand me a crown."
Iacto allowed the feeling of a smile to spread across his thoughts, even as his face remained impassive.
It did not matter what Saul said now. All that mattered was that he had acknowledged Iacto.
The truth was that nothing could prevent a degree of hardship and unrest now. Food was the final currency of life, and anarchy followed in hunger's wake. But in all anarchy there was possibility, and true strength could only shine in a time of crisis.
It had been an age in coming. But this was his time now, and from its trials he would rise.
Sacred Water. Aesir woke to the sound of metal scraping on metal. She raised her head from under the blanket, eyes still fogged by sleep, and smudged dreams of weeping faces and pleading voices.
"Grandfather?" she asked.
The old man was crouched at the other end of the hovel's narrow space. He had a battered metal can in one hand and was scraping at its inside with a blunt knife.
"What are you doing?"
"Water,"
he said, and looked up at her, his smile showing the blackening remains of his teeth.
"I went out. People are talking about this weeping stone saint."
He bent back to scrape the inside of the tin. The knife skidded on the hardened filth on the inside of the can, and the blunt tip rammed into the other hand where it was holding the rim. He yelped, wrinkled face squeezing tight with pain. Aesir was across the room in a blink, taking the blunt knife from her grandfather's fingers and squeezing her hand around his. They were trembling. They trembled more these days. After a second his hand stilled and his eyes opened.
"Bless you,"
he said, and tried to smile. But pain turned it into a wince. There had been more pain recently, and he had started sleeping more. When he did go out into the drift, it was with a wild intensity that passed as soon as it came. He would try and find food, would talk about finding a way to have her adopted by one of the holy orders in the walls, even about getting on a ship to the stars and going away. Those times passed as quickly as they came, and they were getting fewer. They lived off what Aesir managed to steal and find now.
"What are you doing?"
she asked again.
"Water,"
he said, and shivered, and then it came out in a rush, as it often did when he was in the grip of whatever dream he was holding on to.
"There are people talking about this weeping saint, how pure water came out of this old stone saint. People say that one of the girls that found it was pulled up into the clouds, and the other one heard the voices of saints. They are carrying her around in a chair, and she's dipping her hand in the water that people bring her, and they are paying, see? Paying in real coin. People want the water, see? The weeping saint tears, and word will be getting to the other drifts and pilgrim holes soon, and they will want sacred water, won't they?"
His voice trailed off. He looked from Aesir to the dirt-caked can.
"They might pay for sacred water."
His lip trembled for an instant, and a shadow seemed to pass over his face.
"They might."
Then he shook himself and reached for the blunt knife to carry on cleaning the can that in his mind could hold sacred water. Aesir reached and took the can from him, and began to scrape the dirt off the inside.
"You sleep, Grandfather,"
she said. You need your strength.
He looked like he was going to object, and then nodded and crawled back to the ragged blanket.
Not for long, he whispered. We have to get to the pilgrim holes before anyone else.
Yes, grandfather, said Aesir.
But the old man was already falling back down into the only peace that he could find. Chapter 5. The drug vial hissed as it dumped its contents into her vein. Viola blinked, feeling her eyes sting and then the warm prickle in her skin. She held the injector for a second and just let the world be still while it took effect. She felt the dull haze still lingering from sleep drop away. Thoughts began to fire, reaching out and fizzling out when they found nothing to latch onto. She had taken a large enough dose of karma to drop herself so deeply down into sleep that even her subconscious thought patterns had quieted. Now it was time to wake it all up again.
Come on, she muttered to herself, and yawned. The weight of sleep still hung on her, soft and smothering. Come on. Time and tide and all those things.
She reached for the next vial sitting in the silk-lined case on her desk. The liquid inside was the green of new leaves. She had dreamed of the forest gardens on Zaris Plethys, of walking under the dappled light when second spring came. Home. So far away and long ago, before the family had lost a fortune and gained another, before the training and the surgery and everything that came after. It had been warm, and the warm wind had brought the smell of cooking and oil fires from the habdrifts clinging to the estate's walls. She had dreamed that smell too, she realized. Smell, light, shadow, leaves and trees, all of it as real as the wood of the desk. Lights were blinking amber on the disabled comms console. As she watched them, they began to turn red. All right, she said to the empty reading chamber. All right, enough. She snapped the vial into the injector, put it to her neck, and pulled the trigger. This drug was a jolt of fire. She winced, ejected the vial, and was snapping the next one into place before the thought of pausing for just a second more could form. The next two vials followed, one after another, without pause, cyan and crimson, violet and blue. She dropped the injector on the desk amongst the neat piles of scrolls, data slates, and stacks of parchment. A tiny bubble of blood clung to the injector head. Viola sat back, feeling her thoughts expand and multiply. Ingrained loops of analysis spun up, and she felt herself begin to hunger. By the time she activated the data stream linked to her augmetic left eye, the lack of information to process was causing her physical pain. It took her 2 minutes to read the status of the ship, from command status to weapon readiness. Then she began on the material on her desk. Logs and reports, numbers, profit and loss, all of it a cascade that she drank, her eyes not blinking, her face a pale mask beneath her snow-white hair. At last she stopped, and felt the information breathe behind her eyes. It was getting harder to escape. Part of that was time. After a while, the pathways etched into her psyche by the family's savants became deeper, the drug infusions a daily need, data no longer an addiction but a necessity as basic as air. That was part of it. The other part of it was that she was starting to worry what would happen when she wasn't looking. What in the web of all that she controlled for her family and for Covenant would go wrong if she let herself close her eyes? Still, at least she'd been able to sleep, if only for a few hours. The door alert clanged. She looked up, realizing that, apart from the light of the candle hovering above her desk on her servo skull, the librarium was unlit. Yes, she said.
Baal, Lady Viola, from the household contingent. Master Kynortus ordered me to escort you on your tour of the lower decks.
Viola frowned, and Blink accessed a series of records. She was still frowning as she stood and shrugged on a red and black naval-cut coat. The las pistol was in the pocket where she had left it, and the grip slid into her palm like the hand of an old friend.
Enter, she said, and keyed the door release.
Wooden panelling slid aside to reveal slab plasteel, which split and hinged outwards with a hiss of pistons. Viola watched and waited, hands thrust casually into the pockets of her coat. A man stepped through the opening. He was tall, 6'4" at a glance. He wore the red and black of a Castellan-bonded trooper and the burnished steel cuirass of a member of the household guard. His face was lean, the dark hair above dusted with grey. He wore a short sabre on his left hip, a heavy boarding pistol on his right, and carried a brush-crested pressure helm, lacquered black, under his left arm. He moved awkwardly, she noticed, as though slightly off balance, or carrying an injury.
"My lady," he said,
stopping and bowing his head.
"I don't know you," she said.
"Master Kynortus is personally unavailable."
"I know."
"I was ordered to attend you as your life ward."
"Where is Melgor?"
In her pocket, her finger was steady on the las pistol's trigger. One swift movement, and she could tear his head from his shoulders with a shot.
"She is also unable to attend you."
"There is no mention of that in the household contingent reports."
"No, lady, but it is so."
"That is not possible."
She saw the ghost of a frown form on his face.
"I regret that I cannot explain what is possible, only that Melgor is unable to attend, and I have been ordered to attend."
"How?"
she snapped, feeling anger flare, and then wondering at its intensity. The drugs and cognitive rhythms had not kicked in properly. She was still not balanced. Baal looked up at her. His eyes were blue.
"Because she is bleeding out in a Medicaid bay 20 decks down from here."
Viola blinked.
"That has not been... I was not..."
"Live fire drill accident," said Baal. "It happens. I am sure the report will come along."
Viola blinked again, shook her head.
"But..."
She looked up at him, then felt the sway of her still-settling mind steady.
"I don't know you."
Her voice was cold, her finger tensed on the pistol's trigger.
"And nor I you, my lady. But if you really mean to shoot me with that pistol in your pocket, you should take a step back."
She froze, then drew the pistol and aimed it at his head.
"And now?"
"I think you could kill me just fine."
"I don't know you,"
she said again. Part of herself was wondering why she was pointing a gun at a man who might be a bodyguard or an assassin. If he was a killer, she should have already shot him. If he was not, then she was looking more foolish by the second. Another part of her, the part that even all those years of mind sculpting and training had not been able to remove, did not care. This was her library. She was the seneschal of House von Castellan, and she would point a gun at whomever she pleased.
"Who are you?"
Baal looked straight down the gun sight and sighed.
"You know what? To hell with this,"
he said, and dumped the lacquered helmet onto the desk.
"I said it was a bad idea."
"What do you think you..."
"I said this duty was not for me. I said..."
He looked up at her as he unfastened the cuirass and shook it free. Under the armour plate, he wore a quilted body glove in red and black.
"I'm sorry. This is a mistake. Go ahead and take the shot. Frankly, it would make me feel better."
The armour went on the desk beside the helm. A stack of data slates wobbled. Viola took a step. The frown on her face was a scowl.
"What are you doing? You can't just..."
"Renege on a contract. Actually, I think I can. And even if I can't, the only way of enforcing it is to shoot me. And that at least is better than traipsing around like a tin soldier trying to remember whether to bow or salute."
"Is this a joke?"
snapped Viola, surprise flicking to anger. A cord of gold braid and household crest in silver went onto the desk next.
"Joke? Yes, but not a good one."
He turned and walked towards where the door hid behind an expanse of wooden panelling. Shorn of his armour and formal weaponry, he moved with a smooth grace, she noticed, like a feline apex predator. He stopped in front of the wall.
Could you let me out?
He paused, and then bowed his head stiffly.
If it is not too much trouble, my lady.
Viola laughed. The sound rose up the book-lined walls. Now it was Baal's turn to frown.
Where did Kynortas find you? She asked.
Serapho, he said, 1 month back, after you put in to dock there.
The Hive Archives?
It's not all scribes and ink-drinkers.
I know, she said.
In her left eye, details of the Planet Society were flashing across her sight faster than she could have blinked. She was reading the ship records through.
You were what? A thief-seeker?
Baal turned away, looking at the panelling as though he would be able to find a handle or hatch he had missed before.
And Kynortas found you how?
Baal gave a single shake of his head.
He found me. Offered me a contract, and I said yes. Not my smartest move.
Why not?
Kynortas is a long way from a fool, and he doesn't just let anyone walk in here wearing a household crest.
Like you said before, you don't know me. This isn't for me. A mistake.
Viola blinked as a strip of data whipped past her sight.
Baal, formerly Baalan Zur, gun servant to the late scribe-seeker general of the Prime Archipelago, imprisoned after the death of his mistress during a turf war in the lower archive stacks, sentenced to... She paused, the data frozen in her eye. Sentenced to menial servitor conversion for his failure.
Baal went very still, and then he nodded once.
May I go now, please?
Kynortas must have used Lord Covenant's authority to have you released to him.
Baal let out a breath.
May I go, please?
Viola looked at him for a long moment, and then moved back to her desk and activated the door release. The wood and metal slid and folded back.
Thank you, said Baal, and stepped through the door.
Why did I need to take a step back? She asked.
Baal looked back at her.
You said that I had to take a step back if I really meant to shoot you. Why?
Baal looked at her for a moment and shrugged.
You had to draw the weapon. I was 3 strides from you. A guess, but you were taught to extend your arms to shoot. That makes it 2 strides, and I'm under or behind your gun's barrel.
He shrugged again.
By the time the shot went off, I would have been throwing you to the floor. 1 step back, and you would have had time to draw, aim, and squeeze, and I would have been a dead man.
And if you had the pistol?
Baal shrugged.
Honestly, it wouldn't matter how far away you were. You would be dead.
He looked confused for a second, and then bowed his head.
I mean, of course, you would not, my lady.
She laughed again, and threw him the last pistol. He looked up and caught it casually, hand sliding around the grip and covering, not touching, the trigger, she noticed. Professional.
Show me, she said.
What? Show you how dead you would be? No.
She shook her head, the laughter lingering as a grin.
The soul of your craft is guns. I would like to see some of it before you go.
She paused, still smiling.
Please?
All right.
He fished in a thigh pocket and came up with a handful of coins, some tarnished silver, some faded bronze. Viola recognized them as script tokens, silver verses and bronze cant, the currency of Serapho. He looked at her and flicked a single coin into the air. There was a crack of lasfire, a flash of light. Charred metallic dust fell through the air.
Impressive, said Viola, and nodded at the other coins in his hand. What about the rest?
All of them?
Viola shrugged.
Why not?
Baal raised an eyebrow. Then he grinned.
Useless now, anyway, he said, and threw the fistful of coins into the air.
Cleander von Castellan made sure that he smiled as he stepped onto the command dais. He felt like doing anything but smiling. Truth be told, he felt like drinking a lot of whatever spirit he could lay his hands on and then throwing up.
"Did I miss it?"
he asked, and grinned. The nearby deck officers grinned back.
"No, sir,"
said Void Mistress Gast, handing over an order docket to one of a cluster of subalterns, saluting and turning back to the next junior waiting on her.
"You made it just in time."
"I must try harder to be less punctual in the future," he said.
More grins. He took a silver cup of caffeine from a waiting servitor and took a swig. It was all so damned predictable. The tricks, the little jokes helping mask the truth, that everyone on the Dionysius Bridge was on edge. 4 weeks in the warp, 4 bad weeks. The storms had been blowing hard after they had left Serapho and Covenant's meeting with the Black Priest, Hesh. There had been problems in the lower decks, discontent, madness, and ratings trying to dig their way out of the bilge hulls. Cleander couldn't say he blamed them. He had not slept properly in 17 nights, and the night before had been filled with dreams that woke him shivering and sweat-soaked, a scream caught just between his tongue and teeth. Now they were just reaching the point of translation back into reality. Anyone who had seen fewer storms than he might have thought a return to the void should have been a cause of celebration. It was not, though. It was one of the most dangerous parts of a storm passage, when the unreality of the warp gave up a ship to reality, and the two dimensions ground against each other like teeth. And with a storm running, it was worse. They had been threading the worst storms that Cleander had ever seen. So he made sure that he kept his smile in place as he sipped the hot caffeine.
"Approaching calculated point of transition at edge of Dominica's system,"
said a servitor-modulated voice. The navigators never spoke directly when threading the warp.
"Count mark 60 minutes, 60 minutes. Mark the count,"
called Gast from beside Cleander.
"Mark the count.
Mark the count,"
the shouts echoed down the bridge. Bells clanged. Tech adepts began to walk between the consoles. Sensors puffed incense into the air. Light dimmed to amber. Seconds and minutes began to blink across screens hanging from the spine of the room.
"Very good, Mistress Gast," he said,
putting the cup of caffeine down on the servitor's waiting tray. He felt like he was going to throw it back up. A shiver ran through the ship. Cleander thought for a moment that it sounded like something outside running its claws over the hull.
"I hope that wasn't anyone knocking to come in. We simply don't have the room for guests."
A few of the officers managed to grin, but none of them laughed. Cleander made sure that he kept smiling.
"Lord Covenant,"
said Glavius IV Row as he entered Covenant's chambers. He hinged his body into a bow. He had calculated the degree of his obeisance based on reactions to his previous formal greetings and some remarks by the preacher called Joseph and the Lady Viola. He had spent the better part of an hour on the calculations for his posture and the length of time it should be held. Now that he stood before the Inquisitor, bent over, primary arms thrown wide in submission, watching the seconds tick down, he was certain he had made a miscalculation.
"Did you succeed?" asked Covenant.
Glavius IV Row did not move for a second. He had another 3.12 seconds until his calculation said he could rise from his formal bow. He cancelled the time count and straightened. His augmetics purred. His eye rings clicked. He was unsettled. Yes, that was what he was feeling. Unsettled. Perhaps it was their imminent exit from the warp. His calculations and preparations should have removed that source of emotional intrusion into his thought space, but...
"Magos?"
Glavius IV Row's sight snap-focused on Covenant. The Inquisitor had not risen from his desk, but sat with his hands resting on the arms of his chair. A mind-link sculpting apparatus spun around the half-complete sculpture of a face. Glavius IV Row noticed that the movements had a fast, jerky rhythm, like that of fingers drumming in time with unsettled thoughts.
"Magos, is there a problem?"
Covenant was utterly still, his eyes steady. Wrapped in metal and wire, the last of Glavius Fourreau's flesh shivered.
"The undertaking was a success. The device that you placed in my keeping is now functional."
"Good."
"I am not familiar with this pattern of sacred technology."
He paused.
"I am not even sure if it is sacred."
Covenant turned and looked across to where the silver faces of enemies and the gold faces of allies looked down from the wood-paneled wall.
"You have it?"
Glavius Fourreau nodded and reached inside his robes with his secondary arms. The box that he withdrew was small, 8.3 by 14.168 by 5.15 centimeters, made of a grey, petrified wood that he had not been able to identify. The ratios of its dimensions were slightly off, and that had vexed him ever since Covenant had handed it to him. Not as much as the contents had for these last weeks, but still. He placed the box on the desk. Covenant steepled his hands and looked at it. Glavius Fourreau paused for 0.89 seconds and then hinged the lid open.
"It functions as intended," he said. "Or at least so I believe. It is difficult to be certain without having seen it function before. The damage was extensive. Heat and..."
His voice trailed off in static. "Do you know what it is?" asked Covenant.
"I deduced enough of its purpose to assign it a form of designation. Based on that, and the data from Serapho, I can ascribe it a functional title."
He paused again, and felt a mechanism in his cheek twitch.
"It is a predictive etheric resonance sensor."
Covenant lifted the device out of the box. In form, it was a disc of brass and bone, 15.33 recurring centimeters in diameter. At its core, a silver flywheel holding three crystal spheres spun in a bubble of the same material. Symbols that resembled ancient Terran astrological signs covered the disc, etched in hairfine lines. Subtle cogwork murmured inside its case as Covenant lifted it.
"You are right," said Covenant softly, staring at the device. "At least, you are not wrong. This thing responds to tides in the warp, to patterns of energy, to the merging of dreams and thoughts. It was made on Terra. Did you know that?"
Glavius Fourreau paused the question, uncertain if it was rhetorical or a sincere request for information. He was not comfortable. This behavior was outside of the patterns of behavior he had observed in the Inquisitor. He was not certain why Covenant was talking to him. He had absolutely no idea how he should respond.
"I was not aware of its place of manufacture," he said.
"A sect of techno-mystics made it over 4 millennia ago, during the tyranny of Gorje van Dier. The design came to them in dreams. Half the sect spent their lives asleep, waking only to babble what they had seen. The other half labored to turn those dreams into machines. They created many things, and most did not work. But this..." He held the crystalline brass device up between his fingers. "This worked. As soon as they made it, all of the waking members of the sect killed each other to control it. The sleepers never woke. They died while dreaming, never waking. It is an etheric or spectrum, but might also be called a weird scope, and it was used to predict the occurrence of miracles." Glavius Fourreau was silent for a second, hoping and waiting to be dismissed. No such release came. He would have to respond. That was the normal pattern of interaction.
"How did it come into your possession, Lord?"
Covenant looked up at him sharply, and Glavius Fourreau realized that he must have crossed some form of boundary in this interaction. Then the Inquisitor sat back, and the cast of his face changed.
"My master. It was my master's. It is one of the means he used to divine the presence of beings touched by the Emperor's majesty." "He gave it to you?"
Covenant nodded, then looked up. Glavius Fourreau almost stepped back. No. I took it after he died. Covenant turned away, and for a moment Glavius Forro almost did not recognize the man who was his lord. He looked older, but somehow younger, too, alone, with the weight of the past pulling shadows into the recesses of his face. Glavius Forro felt a fact rise in his mind that he was not sure where it had come from.
You regret his absence from life?
Covenant put the weird scope back into its box and shut the lid with a snap. Thank you, Magos, he said. His face was hard control again. You have done good work. You may go. Glavius Forro hesitated, and then bowed and scuttled out of the room.
You have never been on a starship before, have you? Viola said, as they squeezed down a companionway.
Once, said Baal, ahead of her. He had covered his red and black body glove with a cloak of worn fabric, the color of rust. Under that, he wore two las pistols in high holsters and several pouches of ammunition. For her part, Viola wore a black overall and a dark cloak with a deep hood to cover her ivory hair. She sometimes said that the color was a family trait, recessive in the female line. That was a lie, though. The drug and intellect conditioning had bleached it white when she was not even 13, and it had stayed that way ever since. She was proud of it now, but when going down to the Dionysia's deep decks, she kept it hidden.
When was that? She asked.
When I was too young to remember it, said Baal, glancing up at where a viscous liquid dripped from the pipes above. The companionway was narrow, and made more so by the pipes and cable bundles that lined its walls and ceiling. A thick layer of dust and oil sat on everything, fused and set like stone. There was no light, so they both carried small candles in glass bubbles held on wire handles.
People don't have stab lights or power packs down here, Viola had explained when Baal had raised an eyebrow as she had given him his lamp. Void life is different, she said.
Yes and no. It's not so different from parts of the archive stacks. Down in the deep there are places that never see the light, and where you have to crawl through tunnels dug into parchment layers. There's things and people down there that think that light only comes from fire. Seeing a star, let alone being on a lump of metal going between them, would terrify them.
Not you, though,
he snorted. And she saw his teeth flash in a grin. Oh, I am terrified, all right. I'm just working hard to not let it show. He stopped and held up the glass lamp. Sealed hatch. No sign of a release handle.
Let me, said Viola, and squeezed past him, and pressed a ring on her right index finger to the pitted metal.
There was a low thump, and a crack opened around the edge of the hatch.
After you.
He moved past, pushing the hatch open. She noticed that his left hand had slid one of his pistols from its holster as he paused, a frown forming, before he shook his head.
What? She asked.
Why do you come down here? If it is as dangerous as you say, why come down here and skulk about in the shadows with only a gun servant like me as backup? She moved past him, blinking her eye to low-light vision. A short, wide passage led to a larger hatch that hung open. Corrosion crawled over the deck and walls. The air smelled of stagnant water and rust. Light came from beyond the door, flickering and red.
Why come down to the bilge levels? Because you were more right than you know. This ship is like a city, and I am its chief administrator, paymaster, and prosecutor. You think it's all vast fortunes, cargoes of treasure, and a sideline in working for the Inquisition.
Isn't it? He said, with a fresh grin.
Yes, I suppose a lot of it is. But a rogue trader is their ship, and down here, where I'm just a rumor and the void is the promise of death, problems can start down here that, if they aren't dealt with, can leave the ship dead in the void. And if that happens, all the gold in the heavens can't buy your way back to life.
She moved closer to the open hatch door. Another tap of a ring on her left hand, and the compact stummer embedded in it activated.
A bubble of hissing silence swallowed the sounds of their steps. She looked through the gap in the hatch, making sure that she kept back out of the light. Five figures stood in the compartment space beyond. Each of them was pale and long-limbed. Three wore the tattered remains of rating uniforms. The other two, a younger man and an old woman, wore amalgams of vacuum suits, festooned with pieces of rusting metal hung on loops of wire. The old woman held a staff hung with wires and power packs, and tipped with a cracked glow tube. The ratings held drive guns, crude projectile weapons made from rivet drivers.
"Does it speak?" said one of the ratings. "Does the Iron Mother speak?"
The old woman with the staff shifted. Metal clinked.
"The Iron Mother speaks," said the woman, her voice creaking like rope in a wind. "I hear it. I heard it. It speaks. It says that we are bound for night. I hear it speak, and it says we must..."
"A cult," hissed Baal from next to Viola.
"Barely. They are called void speakers. They listen to sounds in the hull. They think they hear the voice of the ship, the Iron Mother. It's an old void superstition. Not just on this ship, either. Some captains try to get rid of them, and after a while they are just there again, different people telling the same story."
"You let them do this?"
"Let them? I do all I can to protect them."
"Why would someone like you..."
"There are many things that happen out of sight on a ship that leave a lot of people dead if you ignore them. The void speakers hear and know things. Plus, if you deal with them properly, they're not so bad."
"So, this is it. This is how you do it." He gave a whispered laugh.
"Do what?" she asked. "You hear and know everything. You're the Lady of Threads," said Baal, then grinned apologetically.
"That is what the household troops call you."
"Because I am like a spider. Yes, I know."
She moved to the door.
"And you should know something else if you're going to guard my life. The name sticks, because that is exactly what I am like."
She smiled at him and stepped through the opening. The five void speakers did not see or hear her until she deactivated the stummer. By then she was five paces from them. They spun at the sound of her next step, and then their eyes went wide, and they folded to the deck. Viola bent down and tugged the void speaker with the staff up to her feet. The woman was feather light, and her eyes were filming with cataracts. The others stood more slowly, careful to keep their heads bowed and not to meet Viola's gaze.
"Honored Elder Yarda," said Viola to the woman. "Mistress, you return to us."
The woman with the staff's head twitched, and she pointed a long finger to where Baal had followed her.
"This one is unknown to the voice."
"He is bound to my life," said Viola.
"For coin? There is no truth in coin."
"He is bound to me, and so to the Iron Mother."
The elder held her milky gaze on Baal for a long moment, blinking slowly. Then she bowed her head.
"He is welcome amongst us."
Viola nodded, relieved.
"What does the Iron Mother say?" asked Viola.
"It speaks of storms and broken dreams," said the elder, and motioned to the deck. "Come, sit, and let me speak its voice to you."
A blast of thruster wash buffeted Joseph as he walked between the black-bodied gunships. The livery of the Adeptus Arbetes had been painted out, and midnight black now shrouded them from nose to tail. The only mark on each of them was a small image of a winged fist set at the heart of the tri-barred Eye of the Inquisition, stenciled in white beneath the cockpit canopies. Arbitrators in black armor moved in the open spaces between the craft, checking equipment. Most wore their full carapace armor, the plates gleaming under the hangar bay's lights. The same symbol that marked the gunships sat on each of their shoulders. The orange stripes of squad leaders were the only other markings he could see. They were not arbitrators now, but wards of the Inquisition, bound by oath to serve the will of the Inquisitor who had summoned them, him
and the judge who led them. They saluted Joseph as he passed, sharp and smooth. He returned the gesture, though it felt as ragged as he did. He needed to... No, he didn't need to sleep. He had tried to sleep, and even when he did, it did nothing. He coughed, and tried not to cough again.
Corriv!
The voice came from behind a cluster of arbitrators. He turned as the group parted.
You have been avoiding me, said
Judge Orsino as she stepped forwards with a whir of exo-armor. She was smiling, but her eyes were sharp glitters. Her head was bare, grey hair cropped close. She walked with a cane, the top capped with a silver eagle's head. In spite of the wrinkled skin and wasted flesh, he still had the feeling that she could beat back a riot by force of will alone.
Not avoiding, he said. Time has just not allowed me to...
Oh, don't be ridiculous. I know when I'm being evaded. The question is, why?
Joseph shrugged and crossed his arms and thought about ways to deny it. Then he sighed and half turned away.
It's something about this operation, isn't it?
It isn't an operation. It's a crusade. Covenant...
He stopped himself and shook his head. He felt angry, he realized, suddenly and intensely angry. Orsino looked around at the nearest arbitrators and gave a small flick of her chin. They bowed and moved away.
Go on, she said, looking back at him.
No, I shouldn't. It is not my place.
If it isn't your place, then more has changed than I see.
Joseph was quiet for a moment.
He has the bit between his teeth. He won't let go, and is...
That is what inquisitors do, my friend. That is the way they are, and the way they need to be.
I know, but there is something in him. It feels personal.
And can you blame him? Idris, after all...
No, it's not just that. He's becoming like he was before Argento died.
And that is a bad thing?
It might be. I am not sure. He is out of balance. I don't want him to face this alone.
Orsino frowned.
Alone? Why would he be alone?
He is always alone.
Yes, but that is not what you meant.
She was staring at him intently now.
Corriv, you will tell me what is wrong.
Pain bloomed inside his chest for a second, and he felt a spasm coming. He clamped his will down on it.
Nothing, he managed to say. Only as I have said.
Orsino's stare had hardened.
I know when I'm being evaded, Corriv. You nearly had me there, and while I believe that you are worried, that is not what is wrong, is it?
I should go, he said, and took a step away. The ship is due to come out of the warp in an hour. There are...
Corriv, are you ill?
He looked at her for a second, while the world flipped over inside his head.
I am fine, he said,
and smiled.
Most of the galaxy has tried to kill me. Nothing has made it yet.
That is not what I...
I'm fine.
I am a very bad person to try and lie to.
He opened his mouth to reply, and then closed it and shrugged.
You want proof. Who is your nastiest?
He asked, jerking his chin at the nearest squad of arbitrators.
They all look tough, but you will have a killer, a real bone-breaker who can always be counted on when you need someone brought in dead.
What are you...
Humour me.
Proctor Gald,
she called. A man with a clean-shaven head broke away from the group and bowed to Orsino. His eyes were pale green, Joseph noticed, his face slim and set.
Cruel, this one, thought Joseph.
Gald moved with the relaxed fluidity of someone who knew how to use the muscle they carried. He flicked a gaze over Joseph and turned to Orsino.
And arrogant, too. Your honour, said
Gald. Orsino looked at Joseph.
The preacher here wants you to show him how good you are in a fight.
Of course, Your Honor. How many of the squad does he wish me to demonstrate with?
Me, said Joseph, stepping forward and folding up the sleeves of his robes.
Just me, lad.
Gold's lip curled a fraction before he could control it.
I am not going to, Your Honor.
Gold glanced at Orsino.
Don't look at her. I am old and fat, but believe it or not, I know what I am asking. Just so that you do, too, I am going to ask. If your loyalty to the God Emperor means that you are ordered to try and beat me bloody with everything you have, will you do it?
Gold nodded without even blinking.
Yes, sir. And you think you can?
Gold's lips twitched as he controlled the smile.
I am well trained.
Joseph nodded and stepped close to him. When he spoke, his voice was low.
So, if I said that you don't have a hope, and that even from the smell of you I think you are a vicious piece of excrement who enjoys it when he is given an execution mission, and is probably only one step up from a reptile, and if I then gave you the choice of trying to send me to the medics with my jaw hanging off, what would you do?
Gold kept his face impassive, but his pupils had shrunk to needle punctures.
I would rip your fingers off and feed them into your fat mouth.
Joseph nodded.
Then do it, boy, he growled.
Gold met Joseph's gaze and then looked away. For an instant, it looked as though he was going to say something. Then he exploded forwards, his first blow so fast that Joseph almost missed it and only just got his arm up in time. Force slammed down his forearm as he blocked it. The second blow came hard behind the first, and Joseph was stepping backwards as the third whipped past his eyes, catching his nose and spraying blood out across the deck. He took another step back.
God! He roared, tasting copper and iron. You are trying!
Gold paused, his eyes fixed on Joseph's, pale and steady.
Come on, come on, thought Joseph. Come on, you cold bastard.
Gold relaxed and flashed forwards, so fast, so fluid, even in armor. Joseph was outside the blow by an inch and felt the shock as Gold realized he was exposed.
Good!
The proctor turned fast, striking as he twisted. Joseph moved an inch inside that blow and rammed his forehead into Gold's face. His nose shattered in a spray of blood. Joseph caught his right arm as he staggered, locked the elbow, and moved just enough to flick Gold off his feet. Joseph pinned him as he fell and looked down into the cold eyes as the proctor gasped for air.
It's all right, lad, he growled softly. I used to teach people who are nastier than you how to do this. And the thing about being old and fat is that I have had a lot of practice.
He released Gold and stood up. The proctor was breathing hard, blood running down his face.
Best patch him up, said Joseph calmly. He needs to be combat ready in an hour.
He turned back to Orsino, wiping the blood from his own face with the sleeve of his robe. The judge did not move. Her eyes were steady on him, her lips pursed, her head tilted to one side, her weight resting on her cane.
Like I said, I'm fine.
He held her gaze, but she did not nod or say anything, and after a moment he turned and walked away between the gunships. She watched him go until he was out of sight. He knew it without looking around.
I'm fine, he muttered to himself. God Emperor, please let me be fine for just a little longer.
He walked on until he found a deserted side passage, then let the coughing and the pain crush him to the floor. Part 2, Season of Night. Chapter 6.
Brace! Cleander von Castellan shouted at the quiet bridge. For holy throne's sake, brace!
Heads turned towards him. Hands moved to controls out of reflexive obedience, even as puzzlement ran through their minds.
Sir,
began Void Mistress Gast. Force snapped through the hull. Structural pillars screamed. A row of system servitors yanked free of their cradles and slammed into the vaulted ceiling. Blood and black oil spattered onto the deck. Cleander swore and pulled himself straight. The deck was still pitching. Bubbles of oily light were fizzing at the edge of his sight. That was not good. That was very not good. Alarm lights flashed from amber to red through the bridge. Klaxons began to sound.
A little late,
he snarled, and he was pulling himself back upright. Crew were scrambling back to their positions. Some were still on the deck, where they had slammed down as the warp translation had whiplashed through the Dionysia.
Get the Medicaid crews,
he roared. Tech priests and deck officers were shouting, Binaric and Voidhand's invective competing with the Klaxons. Cleander saw Gast slumped over the watch station.
Medics! Now!
He bellowed, jumping across to her as the deck pitched. Her face left a smear of blood on the console as he turned her over. Her mechanical jaw hung open. A bead of blood grew at the corner of her eye.
Come on, Arabella, he muttered.
The bead of blood became a fresh red streak down her cheek.
Come on! I will dock your pay for dying! You hear me?
A system console set in the pit beneath the command dais blew out in a wash of black smoke and blue flame.
If I don't get a medic now!
A figure in teal and red robes bent down beside him.
Animus intacta,
croaked the medique as she moved Cleander out of the way. He resisted for a second and then stepped back. The medique was bald, bulbous red augmetics whirred and focus in place of eyes. She had the hunched look of someone too tall for comfort, and her skin was so pale she looked closer to a corpse than the bleeding woman she was examining.
Still alive,
she said. A pair of snake-tailed servo skulls buzzed in, needles extending from clusters of metal fingers set beneath their jaws. Drills spun and jabbed towards Gast's skull.
Wait!
He shouted. A drill punched through Gast's temple. Fresh blood showered out.
What are you doing?
Preserving her life,
said the medique. Her fingers had grown needles from their chrome tips.
That is what you wished, I presume?
What? Yes, but...
Then give me more space and occupy less of my attention.
Cleander stepped back, still staring at the old Void Mistress as blood ran down her face.
Sir, we have red condition through lower decks,
called an officer behind him, quickly followed by another.
Fire in compartments 105 through 190, deck 75.
Another growl of straining metal. Sparks showered through the air. Gast still wasn't moving. The medique's fingers were a red and chrome blur.
Reactor output spike! We are losing atmosphere!
Hull breach in compartments!
He blinked. He needed to get hold of what was happening to his ship. He needed to get up and trust that the medique would take care of Gast. He needed to start being the captain. He was suddenly aware again of the clamor echoing through the bridge. His head was still spinning.
Get me status, position, and external sensor data.
Sir,
answered an officer.
And get me vox links to Lady Viola and the Navigator Enclave.
Sir,
came the replies. He tried to straighten himself, but his muscles were shaking. He felt cold. A bright, bitter taste clung to his tongue. He had been through bad warp-to-reality translations before, but nothing like this. They had been running ahead of the storm front, spreading from Vengeance, one of the three so-called Storms of Judgment. The ship's two navigators had been screaming for most of that passage. One of them had lapsed into coma, but they had reached the translation point and dived back into being with margin to spare. Except they hadn't. Just as the Dionysia had breached the skin of reality, the storms had surged. Vast currents of psychic energy had reached through the ether like hands snatching at a toy. Caught between worlds, the Dionysia had been pulled in different directions of reality. It had lasted less than a heartbeat, but it was enough to almost break its hull in two.
Phantoms had rolled through the ship as ectoplasmic echoes had chased it into the void. Now it was half blind, burning from within, and with half its crew insensible or insane. Bad, very bad, in fact. But as he kept staring at Gust's bloody face, Cleander knew that it was not the storm surge that was making him shake. It was what had happened just before it.
"Sir, we have Voxlink to Lady Viola," called an officer.
He looked at his hand. It was trembling on the rail of the command dais.
"Sir?"
He had felt the surge a moment before it had happened. Not thought it might happen, not spotted something that others had missed, but actually felt reality draw tight and snap back, like a rope pulling taut and then breaking. That was why he had shouted to brace. That was why he had known it was going to happen. Because it already had.
"Brother," came Viola's voice, scratching and popping as it came from the vox speaker, still controlled and clipped as ever, but edged with what sounded like anger as much as shock. "We need external Auspex data. We need it now."
"What in the name of all that is sacred just happened?" he said softly, raising his hand from the rail.
"What?"
said Viola's voice.
"What did you say? The link is going. What in the name of all that is sacred just happened?"
Cleander looked up from his hand to where the spindle-figured Medicae was rising from beside Arabella Gust. Arcs of electric charge raced over consoles as systems flared back to life. A whole new set of alarms began to sound.
"Proximity alert! We have multiple vessels and objects in close proximity. Shields coming online."
"Show," began Cleander, but there was something wrong with the next word.
"Show me,"
he managed. But something was wrong with his legs, and the view was swimming in front of his eyes. Everything was becoming quiet, soft, slow.
"Cleander."
Viola's voice was a stretched purr over the vox.
"I might..."
He felt himself speak the words as much as heard them.
"I might need your help," he said,
and slid down to the deck with the sound of his sister's voice and the blare of klaxons following him down into darkness. The Dionysia tumbled as it came from the warp, spinning end over end, smeared with evaporating ghostlight as it met the cold void. Thrusters fired on its hull. Its tumble twisted, but it spun on, fighting the drag of forces that clung to its hull as the warp storm screamed from the wound it had left in reality. Curtains of light stained the stars, hiding the pure black of the night behind bruise-like auroras. The dead ships were waiting for it, spread out in the dark. Sections of vast hulls slid through the void, the force of their deaths still turning them over like pebbles in a child's hands. None of them had survived intact. Here, a kilometer-long piece of hull lay close to a bridge castle torn out by its roots. There, a prow turned slowly over, smaller flakes of debris forming a cloud that glittered in its wake. On and on the debris field went out. The Dionysia met its first piece of wreckage before it could stop spinning. It was one of the smaller chunks, the size of a small hablock, and serrated like a broken dagger. Its void shields ignited just before impact. Light flashed in the dark. The piece of debris came apart, burning fragments spilling over the ship's prow as it plunged on. Viola saw it all unfold in her augmetic eye as she ran onto the bridge. Baal was behind her. Both of them were still wearing their gear from their excursion to the bilge decks.
"Helm control!"
she shouted as she leapt onto the command platform. A deck officer turned from shouting orders.
"Aye, mistress."
She stopped when she saw Cleander. Her brother was sprawled in the command throne that he never used. Blood streaked to the left of his face, and a wound was clotting on his scalp. Medicae Primus Iaso was bent over him.
"The Duke von Castellan is alive,"
said Iaso, without looking up. Viola looked around at the chaos of the bridge. Her augmetic eye was flooding with damage and sensor data.
"Where is Gust?"
she shouted.
"Incapacitated,"
answered Iaso.
On the screen above, a blurred projection of near-space debris. Viola took two precisely timed breaths and let the world grow still. Shouts and flashes and sound became another strand of data. The information flashing through the screens and chattering from parchment printouts were flows. All of it became like the wind blowing in a forest. It was a technique that one of her savant tutors had called the gaze of heaven, because in reducing the world to that level of data abstraction felt like looking at the world as a god must, everything just an expression of a larger whole, the worst unfolding disaster just a twitch in a flow of variables that had never begun and would never end. It had always seemed to her like a mildly heretical analogy, but having mastered its trick, she had to admit that it was utterly accurate. She saw the tumbling trajectory of the Dionysia, the crew and the warp-storm energies billowing through the void around them, and the tick-tick-tick of time as a weave of values and translations. She saw it and realized that they had very little time amongst the living.
"I have helm command,"
she shouted, and was already calling orders, as the confirming replies came from the bridge crew.
"Fire port thrusters! Course correct 187 by 167 by 84. Full engine burn on my mark."
The Dionysia shook, and the view on the external pict feed screens pitched over. Chunks of ragged metal the size of mountains spun past. The remaining void shields sputtered and flared as micro-debris hit them at the speed of cannon shells.
"Mistress, the shields! Damn the shields! They won't take another major impact. We need to dance out of this graveyard."
"Mistress Viola von Castellan," blurted one of the tech priests, "the sacred cogitators are still processing the optimal pathway out of the debris field."
"That is not time we have."
"Engines blessed and consecrated for 100% burn," called an engine seer from down in the machine pits beneath the dais.
Viola watched time tick past at the edge of her augmetic eye. Her lips were moving, whispering threads of logic and possibility, and pain was already building in her temples. The problem with the gaze of heaven was that human minds were not supposed to function like that. Perhaps the Lex Mechanics of the Adeptus Mechanicus with their machine-looped brains could cope with it, but with a brain of meat, you couldn't look down from the place of the gods for long. The view of the pict screens was still rolling over and over as the Dionysia kept tumbling, its thrusters fighting against its momentum. The severed prow of a macro-hauler spun into view, massive, looming like a mountain thrown into the night. She could feel the bridge crew tense, breath caught in throats, the time values and vector calculations balanced in her mind.
"Fire main engines!" she shouted. "Full burn!"
Force slammed through the ship. It shot forward, its path corkscrewing. The prow of the macro-hauler spun to meet it. The scream of proximity alerts rose. Then they were running past it, close enough that a child could have thrown a stone between the two of them. The Dionysia kept on, its trajectory stabilizing, passing through shard clouds, like an arrow shot through the whirl of battle, never wavering, even as the bones of dead ships tumbled close enough to knock them from the sky. Viola swayed and closed her eyes. A metallic taste filled her mouth, and her skull felt like it was going to explode.
"Once we are true and clear, set course for Dominicus Prime," she said. "Get us in system fast."
She turned as Medike Iaso straightened from beside the unconscious Cleander. She was shaking, she realized.
"Is he all right?" Viola asked.
"The head wound was not severe. His collapse was caused by other factors that I am not yet certain of."
"Other factors?"
"Mistress von Castellan, you above all know that diagnosis, like deduction, is best handled without it becoming guesswork."
Viola felt her mouth open to snap a reply, and then closed it. Flecks of light were glittering at the edge of her sight.
"But in your case, I barely need to guess,"
said Iaso, her carbuncle eyes focusing on Viola.
"Pupils widely and irregularly dilated, vibration in extremities. You are suffering from extreme mental fatigue and a cluster of side effects from cognitive and neural enhancers."
"What's happening?" Joseph
called as he moved onto the bridge and hurried towards the command dais.
Blessed saints,
he breathed as he saw the hollow displays and screens.
The storm is closing,
a strong voice came from behind all of them. Covenant walked into the pulsing alert light. He wore armor over his storm coat, and his psi cannon sat on his shoulder, its targeting lens locked on the void displays. The officers and crew turned to bow. A twitch of his hand dismissed the formality as he came to stand amongst those clustered on the dais.
These are ships that tried to enter the warp, to flee the system.
The image of the spinning wrecks danced silently across the displays, yet Viola could not help but think of screams when she looked at them.
Chewed and spat out, said Joseph. Emperor, guard the souls of those on board.
The storm is contracting around this location, intensifying, focusing,
said Covenant, his eyes moving from the images of dead ships to where a projection of the Dominica system spun in a smaller cone of hollow light.
Events are moving quickly.
We will not be able to get out of the system if the storms do not abate, said Viola.
Two servitors were lifting Cleander and Arabella Garst onto steel stretchers. She glanced at her brother. A trickle of blood was running from the corner of his mouth. For a second, the thoughts running through her head stopped. Then she looked up and saw the green lens of Covenant's psi cannon twitch up from its focus on Cleander's face.
Take us into the system full speed, said Covenant, and turned and took a step towards the bridge doors.
The servitors were lifting Cleander and Gast's stretchers, Medicae Iaso walking at their side. Covenant raised his hand to halt them as they passed.
Viola had been about to start issuing fresh orders, but found that she was watching as the Inquisitor put a hand on Cleander's forehead and closed his eyes.
Viola thought that for a second he looked tired, tired and older than he was. His lips moved silently for a second, then he took his hand away.
Take us in, full speed, he said, and began to walk away. The storm is coming fast.
God Emperor, in your wisdom, hear the words of your daughter.
Severita spoke the words, following the thread of their sound through the tunnels of exhaustion. Grey blurred the edge of her sight, but she kept her eyes steady on the figure clamped within the cryo casket. The plasteel box was tilted upwards. A metal door sealed its front. Pipes led from the casket's sides to clattering machines bolted to the floor. Frost covered the casket, steeling its hard edges with growing crystals.
Grant my soul strength to undo my sins. Grant me agony, that I might reach salvation. Grant me...
The air was thick, clotted with the heat that thumped from the cryo machines. Sweat prickled her scalp and ran down her face. The hilt of her sword was against her forehead, her pistols holstered at her side. The black and red of her armored body glove gleamed under her Hessian tabard. Her vigil had lasted for 108 recitations of the litanies of penance and the pleas for absolution. She kept her gaze directly ahead, staring at nothing but seeing everything. And the words of prayer rolled on, marking the march of unchanging seconds from present to past, while the Dionysia passed through the night on the way to the future. She would need to sleep, eventually. Even faith had its limits. She would attend to that later, once the ship had completed the passage through the Dominicus system to its target. She just needed to stay focused. She just needed to... She stood. The sound of prayer stilled on her lips. Part of her mind screamed at her for breaking the ritual as she stepped forward so that she could see through the view slot in the front of the casket. A silent scream of rage roared at her in the voices of every sister she had known. She raised her hand, wondering what she was doing, and wiped the frost from the glass. Enna Girid's face looked back at her with open, unseeing eyes.
"I have killed many of your kind," she said, paused, swallowed, and continued. "I struck my first blow against a witch on a planet called Rhea. My sword went through it. I don't know if it was a man or a woman. It was just fire."
She paused, hot air filling her lungs at the memory of ash rising in a cyclone through the charred building.
My sword went right through it, from tip to guard. I could not wrench it free, and the witch pulled away and took my sword with it. I looked for it later in the remains. The blade had melted, even the fire gem in the pommel. Until then, I'd thought that blessed steel in the hands of the pure could not be stained or broken by the powers of sorcery. That was what we were taught, you see. That was what I believed.
She took a breath and felt the salt of her sweat sting her eyes.
But the sword was destroyed.
She bit her lip. Beyond the frosted window, the frozen traitor, who had not known what she was, lay unmoving.
It's a question, you see. If I was pure then, was the fire which destroyed the sword also pure? Or was the fire impure, and so was I? Or is there such a thing as purity at all?
Severita winced at the last words. Why was she weak? Why did she give her sin greater strength? Why could she not shed the skin of doubt?
That is the problem,
she said, feeling her jaw clench shut after the words.
I don't know the answer. I don't know if you are unclean, Enagirid, or blessed, or just unlucky. And that is a problem. It's a problem because the strength of faith is certainty, and I just can't hold on to that.
Severita watched the frozen face and tightened her grip on the sword in her hands. The cryo machines thumped their heartbeat rhythm, and out beyond the metal skin of the ship, the void slid past.
God, Emperor, she began again, in your wisdom, hear the words of your daughter.
Did you get bored? Severita spun around. Lightning arced down her sword as the power field activated. A figure hung in the gloom by the door. Withered limbs and dark blue robes hung from a bald head set in a bulbous collar of chrome. Its bare feet hovered just above the deck. A heat haze shimmered around it. Bubbles of ghost light popped and cracked.
You must leave,
said Severita, fighting her jaw muscles, trying to clamp her teeth together. She could taste burned sugar on her tongue. My Lassa, Covenant's thief of thoughts, drifted forwards until she was an inch from Severita's sword tip.
No, said My Lassa's voice in Severita's head. Your part is over for a while. I am sure that fact will come as a relief. I have no orders to leave from Lord Covenant. Then stay. It is all the same to me, so long as you understand that you will do nothing.
The Psyker drifted forward so that she was facing Severita.
You are good at doing nothing, though from that little break in concentration I saw, you could do with more practice.
Severita felt the rage and loathing rise in her like a tide. Mylasa's black eyes were glittering in the pale mask of her face. She held that gaze, feeling her skin prickle with static. Then she let out a breath and lowered her sword. Its power field deactivated with a dry crack.
Well done. That is a lot of control you just showed. Now, please get out of the way and let me do my work.
Severita did not move.
What are you going to do to her?
She is the acolyte of an inquisitor who, until recently, we thought both an ally and dead. Now we know that Inquisitor Idris is alive and decidedly not friendly, and that this creature is an assassin whose identity has been reshaped by a resurrection cult that was responsible for massacring a conclave of Inquisitors. She bore the name Enagirid, but we have no idea who she really is. She showed every sign of being more than a little lethal, and there is a good chance that she is harboring what you would charmingly call witch powers. What do you think I'm going to do to her, Severita?
Severita did not move for a second, and then stepped back.
My thanks.
Mylasa slid into the space in front of the casket.
In case you are concerned, I have orders not to kill her.
Why would I be concerned about that?
I don't know. I don't like to pry.
The slow thud thump of the cryo machines filled the silence. True and pure.
Water! Miracle water from the weeping saint! Shrine water, true and pure!
Aesir kept close to her grandfather as he began to shake the beaten tin cup while they walked down the main walk of the Palace of Pillars. She could feel the sullen hostility in the air. The pebble on its string rattled against the metal. Curtains hung across the doors of lean-tos twitched as they passed. Her grandfather smiled as he looked at the downcast eyes of the few people they saw. The Palace of Pillars was not a palace, of course, but someone had given it that name, and it had stuck. Technically, it was not even part of the halls of the monastery. The brick pillars, which stretched up to the vaulted arches high above, were there to support the floor of structures higher up. The pilgrims had found the space, just like they had the tunnels and forgotten spaces threading through the monastery. They were not supposed to be there, and the shrine guards came down sometimes to clear them out, but they always came back. Where else was there for them to go? All of them had come so far, for hope of healing, or revelation, or peace. Some even found it, but most found that the bones of saints and holy men could not feed them or keep off the cold that blew from the high plateau. These ones were lucky, in a sense. Places in the shelter of the monastery itself cost. Lean-tos of fabric and plastic stretched over scrap metal frames filled the space around the pillars. Cooking fires wound smoke into air that reeked of sweat. The bright tatters of prayer flags and saint kites hung from wires strung between the pillars. An icy draught, which had found its way down from the upper levels, stirred the strips and effigies.
True and pure!
They trudged on. Liquid sloshed in the can Aesir carried. Her fingers were cold. The hunger pain in her gut was a rising ache. There had been no food for the last 2 days, and no one had bought the water.
Grandfather, they're not going to buy the water.
They will.
Aesir looked up at him with the hard stare of a child whose view does not allow for the comfort of little lies.
Why? They haven't so far.
Because it's good, and holy, and because the God Emperor himself will make it happen.
Why didn't he do that in the other places we went?
Now, Aesir, to question is heresy, remember?
Aesir frowned and stared around her.
Besides, we haven't been here before, he said,
smiling around as a man stirring a cooking pot looked away from them.
These people are closer to the blessed places. They have holiness in their hearts.
Her grandfather rattled the cup in the direction of a man peering out of an opening between tattered sheets. Aesir met the man's eyes for a second before they vanished.
True and pure, her grandfather called.
The water hanging from Aesir's back by a rag rope was holy. He believed that, she knew. Everything in this place was holy, from the stones to the people that crowded at its edges and in its roots. It didn't matter that the water had come from a broken pipe he had found out in the pilgrim sprawl. It didn't matter that the real water from the Weeping Saint had lasted only a few minutes and soaked into the ground. It didn't matter that the can she carried it in had been pulled from a refuse heap. It didn't matter because it couldn't matter. Aesir could almost hear his plea in his smile.
Oh, please, God Emperor, let it not matter. Let someone give a coin for a cup, please.
The Emperor will provide, he said,
and Aesir felt him squeeze her hand. They turned a corner.
Grandfather!
Aesir's voice was sharp. Two men and a woman barred their path. They had the narrow, sharp expressions of the unforgiving, and iron bars in their hands. Her grandfather blinked as though only just seeing them. Aesir folded close beside her grandfather. All of them wore tattered scraps of clothes, she noticed, but all had crude blue tattoos covering their right hands.
"Do you want water?"
her grandfather asked, and she heard the tremble in his voice. The woman stepped forward. Her rags shifted.
"That water is not pure," she said.
She raised a heavy iron bar and lowered it so its tip rested on her grandfather's chest.
"The stone saint wept and brought blessings amongst his faithful, but you are peddling lies."
"Your pardon,"
he said, taking a step back. A fourth figure, who had slipped behind him without him noticing, nudged him back.
"Please," said her grandfather, "we will go. I just wanted to..."
"We have touched the true water,"
hissed the woman, her face so close that Aesir could see the rotted pits where her teeth had been. Her hands were twisting on the iron bar.
"We have! We are blessed, and you are a blasphemer!"
A hand grabbed the water canister and ripped it from Aesir's grip. The rag rope strap broke. She fell. For an instant, it was slow, like she was watching what was happening, but it was not her. She felt her grandfather's hand slip out of hers, heard his cry crash into her ears.
"Aesir!" he shouted. "Aesir! Run! Run!"
And the woman swung the iron bar, and her grandfather's last words ended in blood and shattered teeth. Blood. Blood falling in a ragged scatter. Wide eyes and teeth clenched with effort.
"Grandfather!"
And the woman was swinging the bar again, and the others struck too, and her grandfather was falling. Falling. Like a bloody doll. A shattered red ruin for a head. Strings cut. Life left as a half-gasped plea for her to run. And she felt a scream begin to unwind from inside her, and... blackness. She was standing because she could feel the ground beneath her feet, but she felt like she was hovering on the edge of waking and sleeping. She could smell smoke. Smoke and something else. Something rich and bitter. It was quiet, too. The quiet of a dream. No, not completely quiet. There was a light pattering, like heavy raindrops. She opened her eyes. The men and women had gone. Everything within 20 paces had gone. Dark tatters of fabric and wet, torn shreds of meat hung from the wires strung between the pillars, like storm debris snagged on trees. Red rain was pattering through the silent cavern from the red daubed roof. On the ground near Aesir, a flayed and scorched hand sat, fingers still curled around an iron bar. Aesir looked, and the scream that came from her this time was just sound. Chapter 7. "Wait," Memnon called. Ninkara paused and turned back to where the gunship was cycling its engines. She had just loosed one hawk into the icy air and was raising her left arm to loose the other. It was midday, but she had known lighter nights. The scrap of light that existed was hidden behind a layer of leaden cloud that promised snow, if she was any judge. They had set down 10 kilometers from the monastery, intending to arrive on foot and unseen. All of them were swathed in thermal cloaks with fur-lined hoods pulled up over their heads against the ice wind. Besides Ninkara and her master, there were two others, Geddon and the looming silence of Sinis, his head hidden beneath his hood. Geddon had taken the additional clothing despite the fact that her scanning and signal implantations made her glow like a walking stove in Ninkara's heat sight. A tracked autoskid carried the main load of their equipment. If anyone had been there to see them, they might have thought they were going into the wilderness rather than to a monastery the size of a city.
"What is it?"
called Ninkara, raising her voice above the wind whistling across the surrounding rocks.
"A ship has just entered outer orbit,"
said Geddon, her patchwork machine voice scraping against the wind.
Our own ship was just moving to the edge of sensor range when it picked it up. The ship is known. It is the Dionysia, last vessel of the Von Castellan dynasty, and bound in service to Inquisitor Covenant of the Ordo Malleus.
The hawk twitched on Ninkara's gauntlet, but she did not release it.
How is he here?
She asked. Memnon's gaze had fixed on the middle distance. He was a Thorian and trained in prognostication. If he is here, it is because he has read the auguries. He knows that a prospect will emerge here.
And that we are here? Asked Ninkara.
Perhaps, said Memnon, and then shook his head. This should have been dealt with before now, Ninkara frowned.
You say that he took captive an agent involved in the endeavor. Could she have given him information?
Memnon nodded, but did not move. His gaze was still far away. The wind gusted. Above them, Ninkara's hawk let out a low cry of hunger. It is possible.
How do we proceed?
Memnon looked at Ninkara. The prospect will manifest here, and it will happen soon. When it does, it must be removed. This development does not change that. He nodded to himself. But the danger to the endeavor must be removed. The agent he has captured must be killed, along with any who have learnt what she may know. Ninkara nodded, understanding what she needed to do without him needing to speak an order.
If he is coming to the surface, he is unlikely to bring a captive, she said. So the ship...
Memnon nodded, and then looked up as a large snowflake fell from the dark sky. He held out a gloved hand and caught it on his palm. Another flake spun down, and then another, and another.
Atmospheric disturbance is increasing, buzzed Geddon. I am reading paradoxical charge patterns and etheric disturbance across a significant area.
The wind gusted and brought with it a wall of white shards to kiss Ninkara's face. The snow was settling on the ground already.
It is rising, said Memnon, as though to himself. It is rising.
Ninkara turned back towards the gunship, flicking a hand gesture to the pilot to drop the closing rear hatch. The hawk she had loosed into the sky swooped low and landed on her shoulder. She turned back just as she reached the ramp. Memnon, with Sinis, Geddon, and the auto-skid in front of him, was almost at the edge of the rock bowl.
What about Covenant? The word is he is hard to kill.
That is my concern, called the Inquisitor, and walked on.
Ninkara watched him for a second, and then went up the ramp into the gunship. 7 seconds later, it lifted off, thrusters kicking the newly settling snow up into night.
How did it take so long to find? Asked Iacto through the fold of cloth he had pressed to his mouth.
The taste of vomit was still thick in every breath, even through the cloth, and brought another wash of the stench. He blinked, trying to hold what remained in his stomach down. The gusting wind brought another lungful of stench, and he had to focus so as not to let it overwhelm him. His head was pounding. Senior Shrine Guard Loa held out the breath mask she had first offered Iacto before they had entered the Drift Valley. He had refused then, thinking of the indignity. Now he was sure that vomiting uncontrollably had been a more grievous blow to his holy dignity. Neither Loa nor the squad of Shrine Guard with them had shown any sign of amusement or contempt. Perhaps they thought that in the face of what waited in the pilgrim hole, a little vomit was the least that could be expected.
Your Holiness,
said Loa, nodding at the breath mask. Iacto took it and fumbled the straps over his head. The rubber-scented air that filled his mouth was a blessed relief. For an instant, he thought that he must look strange indeed, robed in grey with a purple stole, hung with his chain of office, and his head hidden by a mask shaped like an exaggerated face of sorrow with a heavy filter plug for a mouth. Set beneath the bronzed lobster helms of the Shrine Guard, they looked intimidating, even fierce. On Iacto, it must look bizarre. The Shrine Guards of the Congregation of the Bearers of the Lamp were neither priests nor members of a holy order.
Long ago, the blessed Saint Sebastian Thor had banned the ecclesiarchy from keeping armed forces. And so, in many places, and in many ways, the priesthood had found methods of keeping Thor's decree and surviving in a universe defined and maintained by war. In the Monastery of the Last Candle, this practically came in the groups of men and women who took oaths to protect the sacred places and those who tended them. Several hundred strong, clad in quilted leather armor sewn with prayer medallions, and all bearing iron maces beside their other arms, they were intimidating and effective in keeping the pilgrim-drowned monastery peaceful. Armed by arms given by pilgrims and bearing no formal connection to the ecclesiarchy, the shrine guards were technically a militia, raised and maintained by its members out of devotion to the god emperor. In reality, they were the enforcers of law and order in the monastery, and the high sentinel of all sacred places wielded as much power as the head of an order. For that reason, Iacto had been careful to find allies within the shrine guard ever since he had begun his ascent, and had seen such cultivation pay off time and again. Loa was one of his most valuable assets. Clever, but not too clever, and with enough flaws to exploit that he now owned her utterly. Now, on the eve of the Festival of Light, a hasty message from his tame guard had brought him here to a fetid and forgotten part of Pilgrim Drift as the snow fell from a black sky, which would not grow lighter after the passing of night.
"It took this long to find, because there is no reason to come out here," said Loa. "Pilgrims that live here might be luckier than those further out in the drifts, but they still have nothing worth the trouble."
They were standing on the top of a flight of steps that led down to the floor of a covered cistern set in the close-crammed alleys and shacks of the western pilgrim drift. This part of the shanty expanse was so close to the true monastery that he could have thrown a stone and hit its outer wall. He looked down into the pit again and wished he hadn't. Under the light of the shrine guard torches, the floor of the cistern was dark red, almost black. Almost. Handprints were smeared across its walls. Insects crawled over everything, the buzzing of their wings a low rasp against the wind in the silence.
"How could this—"
he began to ask, and trailed off, finding that speaking made the taste of bile stronger in his mouth. He coughed and dropped his eyes.
"It would have taken—" "A lot of people," said Loa. "And no one heard anything?"
She shrugged.
"There are no pilgrims in the buildings nearby. Either they cleared out or—"
"Who else knows?" he asked. Loa shifted.
"The High Sentinel has sent messengers to the Holy Bishop and to the Voice of the Concordance. I got word to you first, but they will know by now." "This is going to cause a riot," said Iacto. "There is already trouble in the drifts. Sickness, too, spreading fast, really fast. But this is heresy."
His eyes had caught something amongst the buzz of flies, half hidden by shadows.
"Give me your torch,"
he said, and when she had handed it to him, descended a few steps and held the light up to the cistern wall. Loa hissed a curse from behind him. On the rough plaster, written in smeared letters that trickled to the ground, were words. "Your God is dead," it read. The hand that had been used to paint it sat at the base of the pillar.
"Or something worse than heresy," said Iacto, blinking back the sudden stab of a headache. "What do you mean, Your Reverence?" I don't know." "Is this... you said you wanted to know about anything significant. Does this... did I..."
He turned and put a hand on her shoulder.
"You did the right thing coming to me, Loa."
She nodded, but his eyes had caught on a battered metal can sitting amongst a mass of putrefying entrails, and he thought he might vomit again. He turned away and made towards the safety of the steps, up and out of the space.
"Just the same as before. Hunger," said Loa. "There have been skirmishes for days now since the orders cut their arms. 10 dead this morning over 3 loaves of bread.
Hmm. He began to walk away, frowning inside the ridiculous breath mask. This new incident changed everything. When news of it got out, and there was no way it wouldn't, then things would become unstable. And, for all his sins, Abbot Iacto did not like the thought of that at all. The gunship hatch opened, and the wind and snow reached in.
"It was snowing the last time we were on this planet, too," muttered Joseph, as the air flicked the edge of his robe.
He had added a fur-lined cloak on top and an armored body glove underneath, but the cold blast still stung.
"Do you think the sun ever shines here, or is it just us?"
Orsino shot him a look, the servo bracing around her neck clicking as she turned her head. He shrugged.
"Just us, then."
Covenant stood before the opening ramp, his face bare above a red cuirass and grey storm coat. His sword was sheathed across his back. The mind-link psi cannon on his shoulder was still, its targeting lens steady and focused. Behind him stood Joseph and Orsino. The judge wore the full regalia of her office, exo-braced armor under a split black cloak edged with ice-link's fur. On her head, supported by servo-bracing, was a gilded headdress of an eagle, its claws clutching scales, its beak a lightning bolt. Behind them were Koleg, impassive in storm coat and breath mask. Glavius Forrow hunched over to fit in the cabin. And last of all, Astropath Epicles, shivering like a leaf, despite a swathe of black fur hiding all but his thin face.
"As much as formality needs to be observed," said Epicles, "is there any chance this could be over with before half of us, and more importantly, I, die of exposure?"
No one replied. The ramp touched down. Orsino's black and red-clad arbitrators had swept out of the 2 flanking gunships and were formed up beside the ramp, guns ready and hunter servo skulls hovering above them. Scanning and targeting beams glittered through falling snow. The engines of all the gunships were still running, ready to launch them back into the sky at a moment's notice. Another 3 were circling above, cutting through the rising wind, gun mounts tracing the landing pads and the buildings around them. A crowd waited at the edge of the pad. Joseph could see faces beneath hoods, faces lit by the streaming flames of gas torches carried on iron poles by white-robed bearers. Rows of men and women in the robes of dozens of orders huddled together as though for warmth. From the looks on their faces, though, Joseph thought it as much terror as cold.
"The coming of the Inquisition is like seeing the face of the God Emperor to some."
Argento, Covenant's long-dead mentor, had once said that, and Joseph had seen its truth many times. At the head of the throng stood a woman, mitred and robed, and bearing a staff topped with a lit candle held under a crystal dome. Gilded chains hung from her limbs, waist and neck, but even bent by their weight, he could see the strength in her face before she knelt.
"In the name of the God Emperor, we greet and honour his anointed Inquisitor, and place all under his will, and subject all to his judgment."
Covenant did not move. On his shoulder, the psi cannon panned slowly left to right and back, over the kneeling delegation. The targeting lens whirred as it narrowed its focus. Joseph followed its movement with his own gaze. There was something wrong, something written in the fear on the faces and their trembling hands. Covenant had seen it, which was why he was waiting. That, and as an emphasis of power.
"You are whistling," muttered the astropath, just loud enough that Joseph could hear.
Joseph frowned, then realized that he was indeed whistling, quietly but clearly, the tune an echo of times long past.
"It's that ridiculous void-farer's hymn that you inflict on us all whenever the blessed God-Emperor sees fit to visit you with a scrap of enjoyment," said Epicles. "I thought you had broken the habit, but maybe it's just that you are rarely in good spirits in my company."
He sends mysteries to test us, and trials to make us stronger.
Covenant moved down the ramp. Joseph, Orsino, and the rest followed. The robed priests and monastic leaders remained kneeling. Covenant stopped a pace from where the bishop knelt, her symbolic chains pulled on the snow-covered stone beside her. Zelita, that was the name in the files Viola had prepared.
"What is the darkness that weighs upon this place?" asked Covenant.
Many of the kneeling figures flinched, and muffled gasps hissed against the snowy wind. Joseph watched them. This was not Covenant's way. He was not an inquisitor who came and used fear to pull petty secrets from the mouths of the masses. He was a scalpel that cut only where it needed to. But he knew the tools and uses of terror and spectacle, even if he chose not to use them. Bishop Zelita looked up and rose.